The title's kind of long, and my plan is, of course, longer than I would have time for. So the first thing I'm actually going to skip is a real definition of free differential fields. So actually, most of the talk will be about partial differential fields, which are somehow more simple. I'll just give some examples of free differential fields to give the taste, but most of the things will be about partial differential fields anyway. So just, I suppose the ambitious plan is to mention free differential fields. Then talk about the model completion for the differential fields. Then I'm going to give a geometric version of. So at this stage, from here on, I'm just going to talk about partial differential fields. So a geometric version of the theory, the model completion, which is dubbed, let's say, partial differentially closed fields. And then I'm going to talk about the, let's call it, partial differential Hendel's lemma, a version of Hendel's lemma for partial differential fields. So it's kind of ambitious. I'll be very vague, not give almost any proofs, but if I'm being too vague, please stop me, because I tend to do that sometimes. So one, I'll just give first definition of partial differential fields. So a partial differential field is a field F given with some finite number n of commuting derivations b1, bn on F. So the language of partial differential fields will be just the language of fields, and you add, I'm used to this, I know this is more common, right, the delta like Bohemius, but I thought of trying to write like this, but I'll just switch in the middle. So the big D's are the differentials. And so I just add n function symbols, and let's say one of the axioms is that they commute. That would be one of the axioms. So the Lie differential field version, which again I'm just going to mention and not go into, would be to generalize a bit and say, suppose it's not really commuting, but it is given by some linear combination of the other derivations. So k goes from 1 to n. So the commutator of di and dj is some linear combination of the n derivations. So you might ask, where do those constants alpha ij k come from? Right? It's a fair question. So for the Lie differential field version, I am assuming some field in the background which contains these constants, and some Lie algebra given over this field, which is given. And then a Lie differential field would be a field with derivations who realize these commutation relations. So again, I'll give just an example, but really you can ignore the Lie part and just think the whole lecture about partial differential fields. It's perfectly okay. So I suppose it's funny to give an example of something I didn't define, but somehow I gave definitions in previous talks. It always takes too much time, doesn't help understanding. So an example would be, let V be, of course I forgot the starting remarks. So first of all, this is a report about work I did in the Hebrew University with Udi Roshovsky. Second of all, I suppose I should make this clear now that I'm talking only about fields of crash 660, and I'm assuming, well, it's written there, that let's say this Lie algebra is finite dimensional over the field. So I'm given a finite number of derivations, whether they commute or not. I'm assuming the finite dimensionality of the Lie algebra. So I said that, at least. So let V be a complex algebraic variety, and let V1 up to Vn be a basis. Oh, sorry. Excuse me. Before that, I want to define. Okay. So, K, which is the field of rational functions on V, is going to be naturally a Lie differential field. In what sense? Is naturally a Lie differential field. Let V1 to Vn span the derivations over C of this K over K. So, well, it's a n-dimensional variety, so we have the basis for the derivations on this, the derivations on the rational field. We have some n derivations spanning them. And so we have some constant, some what's called structure constant in K, such that the commutator of Vi and Vj is indeed the sum. Okay, because the commutator is again some derivation on the field. So take the minimal field that you can, the field that spans, that are generated by all the constant alpha I, j, k, and let's say the Lie algebra that I want to talk about is just the span over this F of V1 up to Vn. So somehow I don't get all the derivations, but if I allow extension by scalars to all of K, I get the whole derivations of K back. So this would be an example of where I'm given a finite number of derivations on K, but they don't commute. They satisfy some given commutation relation. Now, you might notice that actually this L is not really a Lie algebra over F, but satisfies some shifted Lie. So I'll write that down, but again, it's not central. So just a quick note to get the flavor of the Lie thing, and then I just won't talk about it anymore. Note that actually L is a shifted Lie algebra over S. So it's not defined as shifted Lie algebra. I'm just going to define it now. You get this. If you want to extract an alpha from S outside, well, it's not necessarily a constant. These alpha jk, they come from the functions. They're not constants. They're not from C necessarily. So you'll have to get the usual thing, but you'll have to introduce a shift. You have to differentiate alpha, and it might be non-zero. So that's what I call a shifted Lie algebra. Again, just gives a flavor. So that's an LDF, but I did not give a definition. So now I want to talk about the model completion. So first, it's not a Lie, well, it is a Lie algebra over something, over the constant, the mutual, the constant, the constant field of all the di dj's, but it's not f-linear. The bracket is not f-linear. It's just a shifted f-linear. And it's important because I could have thought of it as a C-Lie algebra, but then it wouldn't be finite dimensional. It's not finite dimensional over the complex numbers. So I have to decide, and I want to keep the finite dimensionality, so I skip the being exactly Lie algebra, but I do have this, and it's, I mean, it works out. I mean, whatever I do works out. You know, I won't tell you exactly what I'm doing. So in two, I suppose I should state the theorem, which independently was proven by Tracy McGrail and by me and by David Pierce, that PDF, let's call it zero, so I'm going to talk about partial differential fields, square six is zero, has a model completion. So I'll just say that Tracy did it mainly, I mean, I don't claim to really have read her work, but she followed Kolchin's book and many of his terms. And Pierce, he has a preprint which talks, it's really interesting, about differential forms. So it's an approach to this using the duals and talking about differential forms. I think he did most of the work actually when he was here, right? And what I did was find Bloom axioms. So I'm not going to rely on the audience knowing DCF 0 and the Bloom axioms for DCF. I'm just going to somehow describe vaguely the model completion, and it is a generalization of the Bloom construction. So if you don't know the Bloom construction, you're going to get some idea of it here, hopefully. And and what I did also applies for LDS, but again, it doesn't really matter. It's only a technical, some more technical difficulty. So let's talk about PDFs. So the idea is to generalize Bloom's description of ordinary differential fields of square 660. So the Bloom axioms, they're in only one variable. They talk about, they analyze simple extensions of differential fields. So I have to analyze simple, meaning just that I add one more new element, simple extension. So let's say I have, this is a PDF, and this is the usual differential notation, so I add a new B, but if you think about it algebraically, I have to add B and all its multiple derivatives, right? So I want to analyze how it looks. So take the case N equals 2, meaning I have, it's a span of D1 and D2, this Lie algebra. I have just two derivations, and it's interesting enough to see what's going on. So I added B, and I have to add its multiple derivations, which I'll just draw something like this. So I have D1 of B, D1 square of B. Here I have D2 of B, D2 square of B. Here I have D1, D2 of B. In general, I have D1, I1, D2, I2 of B, which I'll dub the I of B. So I is some multi-index, and I have all of these guys coming into the picture. So how would I analyze what's going on? So I'll just write again without those. And the idea is to choose some order in which to pass over all the multiple derivations. So a natural order would be this order. Maybe I'll just give some relation to the Lie theory. So in the Lie theory, well, if they were not commuting, then I would be missing things like D2, T1 of B, which would not exactly equal D1, D2, but it does equal D1, D2 of B, plus shorter things. The correction is shorter things, i.e. multiple derivations with less derivations. So that's why I want the order to respect length, to first go over B itself, then the multiple derivatives where I have only one derivative, etc., etc. That's the idea. But never mind, at least it's a good order. And let's say, what do I mean pass? I want to check for algebraic information. I want to analyze how this extension looks like. So, well, B could be just algebraic over A, but then I'm done easily. But suppose it's not, and it's transcendental, and this is transcendental over A and B, and I have transcendental behavior all the time, so I have no algebraic information. It could happen forever, but that wouldn't be interesting. Suppose I have some place where I have algebraic information. So I'll just write a quick computation which will give the flavor. Okay, I'll draw this again and again. I wouldn't erase that. That's a bad idea. Okay, so suppose some multiple derivation satisfies a polynomial over, well, A and B, D1 of B, all the DJs of B for J smaller than I. So the smaller is the relation, the order which I didn't define, but basically it's lexicographic order plus respecting length. So it satisfies some polynomial F of Di of B, which is a sum of Pi, I goes from 0 to some degree, with these come from this field. I didn't want to put this, right? I need, of course, the algebraic field generated by A and all the multiple derivatives up to this point. So if I have an algebraic connection, apply, let's say, D1 would give me that, well, D1 of this, which is, first of all, I have to apply D1 to those PIs. Then I would have to apply it to this, which means I have di, b, di, b, di minus 1, and I have d1, di of b. So in the picture, let's bring back the picture because I don't have to draw it again. This means that for this thing here, which is d1 of di, the next derivative, they have a formula. It's the basic computation from differential algebra, but of course it works here too. So I have a formula. I just maybe should point out that this, so this is zero, of course, because it's the d1 of zero. Right, so I had an equality to zero, so it's still zero after I apply d1. But just note that this is really not zero because it's a simpler polynomial. So, and I picked F to be the first, not only the first rank, not only the first differential rank where it happens, but also I picked the first degree. So this is simpler anyway. So this works, and it means that for the whole, okay, so if this works for here, of course it will work for D2 of the I of B, and I will get formally for the whole area here, for the whole quarter plane here. And formally means there will be no new algebraic information. All the algebraic information for this area is derived from here. So it's a good thing to compare this now to what happens in the case of n equals 1, meaning ODEs or differential fields, right? Ordinary differential equations where I have only one derivation. Then I would have this, and it could happen that all of these are transcendental, and at some stage D1 of B will be algebraic. But then I have full information all the way through. So this completes the analysis. And indeed, the Bloom axioms, well, I didn't. Okay, so the Bloom axioms have only one polynomial, one differential polynomial, and you can't have any more information. And here it's not true. I have full information here. And I have I have full information about this because it's transcendental, but still I have to continue searching and I might have more information. I might continue searching for information. Well, I'll skip this area, but at some stage I will hit another point which has more information. I'll collect more and more polynomials. So that's the basic difficulty of going to n equals 2 and above. So let me just give some, of course, all very vague. So I'll just give some words. So let's say for the if I have some algebraic polynomial here, so it means some differential polynomial, a solution to this polynomial will be called generic if it doesn't solve any polynomials of smaller rank. And likewise in this case. So I would call a solution to this F a generic solution if it indeed this was the first place I had algebraic information, if indeed all of these were transcendental. So I'll just say that for the ODE case, the axiomatization of DCF0 just says every differential polynomial has an almost generic solution. I cannot say generic because I cannot say about all the polynomials of smaller rank at once. But picking a finite number, meaning almost generic, in a saturated model I will get generic, so that's basically it. Just says every polynomial has a almost generic solution. Now, it's not exactly every, right? Because if I had, as usual, a non-zero constant polynomial, it wouldn't have a solution. But that's, we're used to that, right? Like in ACS, we can't say 1 equals 0. But that's it. That's the only contradiction I might encounter. So I should say, at least write it, I suppose, that for n equals 1, the model completion is just defined by saying every, and somehow you have to remember that it's a non-constant differential polynomial has, and you have to remember it's almost generic solutions. A n. Almost generic solution. So I just have time to mention why this can't work that easily here. So think about it. I'll just write the two examples which show that, of course, let's say what we might have wanted. We might have wanted to say, so every system of polynomials, like the ones I indicated, so let's say I have here another polynomial, and then another. Of course, an important point to note. Okay, that's an important point. So first of all, note that if I go on collecting this new algebraic information, I cannot go an infinite number of times. So for n equals 2, it's somehow evident because this already covers quarter of plane, and here I have a finite number of rows, here I have a finite number of columns. I cannot collect more than a finite number of polynomials. For bigger n's, it's just either easy induction or an easy exercise. So in truth, the number of polynomials is finite, which is, of course, makes you very happy if you want to first orderize things. But anyway, if I have this finite number of polynomials, well, these are okay because they came from some kind of B. But let's say I want to go back and say every system has solutions. So that's the first approximation of the model completion. Every system has almost generic solutions, but it can't work. So let's just point out two things. First of all, I had full information for all of this, but this also gives me full information. So for this area, I have too much information. It might be contradictory. I mean, for this point, for example, I have a computation derived from this equation, which I have here, but I have another computation derived from this equation that I have here. Now, if someone just throws on me this system without worrying about anything, then these two computations need not give the same, just no reason to give the same computation here. We didn't have, of course, the problem here because here we only have one polynomial. And another more stupid thing, I suppose, it's something like that. So you might have too much information. It will be just contradictory. That first problem, and you might have, let's say the first polynomial was F1 in something like that. Then F2 would just look like this. It will be F1 times this to some D plus 1. So they, and this is, of course, if I want this and this to be 0, it's a little hard because, I mean, we're used to the fact that the leading coefficient is non-zero, but here I'm writing it as a differential polynomial, which I don't know if the leading coefficient is going to be non-zero because I made a commitment here. So I would like some conditions to that I can put on the system of polynomials to assure me two things. First of all, that some polynomials, which I might call compatibility polynomials, do go to zero. The difference between the two computations, and that other polynomials, let's say the leading coefficients here, should go to a non-zero if I take a generic enough solution. So that's our problems, and we need, of course, first order conditions. So I'll dub them Z and NZ for zero and non-zero, but actually they depend, of course, on the system S. The system S is the system, finite system of differential polynomials that I collected, and now somebody throws on me the system and asks me to find whether there exists a generic solution. So I say to him, if you have a contradictory information, I cannot produce a solution, and if the leading coefficient is non-zero, that I'm not willing even to consider because it might be as bad as this. And actually, I want also the separands, which I will not define now. The separand is just the non-zero thing there. I want them to be really non-zero, and I can't assure that. So I need, anyway, first order conditions, which depend on S, such that if, let's say, a polynomial P, differential polynomial, satisfies the Z, then computing it, well, I didn't say what B is, but computing it at the solution of S, then P also is zero, and if the polynomial satisfies the non-zero, then computing P at this B will give a non-zero. So I suppose that's enough for a sense. So the model completion will say that every system of polynomials, which in addition to being looking like that, also satisfies some conditions. So some compatibility polynomial satisfies the Z condition, and the leading coefficients and the separands satisfy the non-zero condition. Every such system has almost generic solutions. So that's basically the model completion. Of course, I should try to reach 4, so we should go through 3. 3 is interesting in itself. Somehow, for us, it came in the way to 4. But of course, it's very natural because we have the more geometric symmetrization of DCF0, so you want something of the sort here. So maybe I should give the flavor of the geometrization of DCF0. So I want to give some kind of more geometric attitude. So suppose D solves an ordinary differential polynomial. So I'm going to write it explicitly because I suppose I didn't write it by now. So S of B being 0, but it's actually S, a regular polynomial in B, B of B until some, I mean, it has some finite rank, the rank n. So suppose B solves this differential polynomial. Instead, we can think of the tuple B, DB, DNB, solving, and this is the usual trick of adding variables and making the differential equation be of rank 1, right? So I want to think of it as solving, I have to add some notation. So let f hat of x0 to xn be, so this differential polynomial is actually a regular polynomial in so many variables, so I want to say it explicitly. So f hat will be that polynomial, so x0 up to xn stand for d of x, etc., so such that f of x is actually f bar of x dx up to the n of x. Right? It's, instead of thinking of a differential polynomial in a single variable, I have ordinary polynomial in n plus 1 variables. And then I think of this as solving the equation, first of all, that f hat of it would be stupid to write it with this because it would be confusing. I want to write it with variables, of course. So I want to write that it solves that this equals 0, but in addition that the d of x0 is x1 until the d of xm plus minus 1 is xn. So I'm saying first that it's a tuple that satisfies this polynomial, but it's not just any tuple. It's exactly that x1 is the d of x0, et cetera, et cetera. So this is algebraic, but this is some differential, which some differential equation. So actually, I can write add. It doesn't cost me money because we know that we have computation for d of xn. So I will add this and write it like some sn of x0 up to xn. This is what Rahim said, that we actually have some rational function which we wrote explicitly, and I can think of the whole of this as saying that d of this tuple x is some f of x. Actually, it's some rational function. So this is a way to do that. And, okay, I won't say what, this is just a translation. Go on to say, I'll just go on. I don't want to give the version of DCF. I just want to say that the same translation, I didn't really make any statement, but the same works with let's call them partial differential systems, like we had earlier, but off finite delta. So again, Rahim mentioned that, and let's just give the picture of what do I mean. Finite delta rank would mean that, I didn't maybe say that, but that's an interesting part of the theory, that it might be that, let's say I collected these three polynomials and that's it. I really am left with an infinite number of unresolved, transcendental elements. Of course, it can happen also here, but here it's somehow the trivial, just differentially transcendental element. And here I have partial information, so this is what we call the infinite delta rank, right? Where, or as Rahim said, the differential rank bigger than zero, or differential, don't remember the phrase, rank? Type, differential type bigger than zero. But it might happen, let's draw it here, that I have somehow a polynomial here, and then a polynomial here, and polynomial here. It might happen that the number of variables is finite. And then I can do the same thing. I can, again, translate, instead of talking on the single b here, I can talk of all the multiple derivatives that I have, and I can think of b solving the system as some tuple whose size is exactly the area of this. So I have some finite number of things, and they solve some three polynomials plus some differential type of equation, like dx equals some rational function of x. So that will work just the same here. Just note, or I won't give the computation. Note that, so now we get, so we have some v. I should say something. Going back here, note that, well, f goes from V not, this is what, I don't know exactly how it's named, but it's the, I suppose the prolongation, right? But I will call it the, so the usual T of V is the tangent bundle, though this I can call the torsor bundle or something like that, but it's the shifted tangent bundle. Let's not call it torsor bundle, not to add words. It's a shifted tangent bundle, which I'll just define. So the usual definition of the tangent bundle can be given, if this is in some an, then it can be given as it's a fibered bundle where over every x in V I have all the y's such that the what's its name? The gradient for every f in the ideal of V, the gradient of f cross this y, well, equals zero. Right? This is some vector space. Vector space that is tangent to the variety. So it's all the vectors who are, perpendicular to the gradient of V. So this is the usual coordinate, non-coordinate free definition. But now I want to shift it because I want to somehow take account of this the derivative we have. So I want to add, so this is in X. But I also have to add a shift of F. So F with D is just applying D to all the coefficients of F. So again, if you're not used to differential algebra, it seems a little mysterious, but it's really, for example, if you want, it's a good exercise. So I don't know if you call it exercise or computation, but the pair X and DX is always in this TD of V. So maybe I should say a few words. So why did I call it a torsor bundle? Because note that right now, since I shifted it, y equals zero is no longer a solution. So I don't have a natural choice of zero for every fiber. So that's why, well, it has some affine structure, but it's not a vector space. So we call it a torsor. A torsor is just a vector space who doesn't have a zero. So if I add a single point, then I would regain a zero in the structure of a vector space. And, well, just I suppose it's worth noting that, well, this is some natural section into this, right? It's a choice for every fiber I choose this point, but it's not an algebraic section. So actually, I don't know if it's even possible. Let's say into the tangent bundle, you have, of course, the natural section going to zero, and somehow maybe it might be possible that since this doesn't have natural zero, maybe it doesn't even have an algebraic section, but it sounds a little far off. But never mind. This is a section, but just note that this section, although very natural and canonical, is not algebraic. So having said that, I can now go back to this case where I will have the setup here will be this V, which is of codomation 3 because it's defined by 3 polynomials. And I will have two things. I will have an S1 into the shifted tangent bundle shifted by D1, and an S2 into the bundle shifted by D2. Because for every one of those, let's say for this thing, I want to have a computation of D1 of it and of D2 of it. So these are given by these rational functions, rational sections into. So this I call torsor fields. Why do I call them torsor fields? Because instead of vector fields go into the vector bundles, so these go into torsor bundles. So these are the torsor fields. So I have this setup, and again, to ask for a solution to the original system is the same as asking for a point on V such that S1, so finding a solution D to the system S, let's say it has those three polynomials, is same as finding U in V such that V1 of U is is S1 of U and B2 of U is S2 of U. Right, B is one of those. Right, I should have wrote it like this, maybe. B bar is the tuple which of the whole thing, that's right.
So when I'm thinking B1 and B2 of the whole thing,
I'm moving. Right, so in most coordinates it will be a trivial rational map, but let's say from here it will be interesting to both sides, right? So it's the same here. Here again, I have just one coordinate in which I have an interesting rational map. And the point of all of this was to say that, well, actually what I have with these two vector fields, since I'm assuming it's a PDF and that D1 and D2 commute, these two torsor fields commute. So what do I mean? How do torsor fields commute? I don't know exactly what the usual definition is, but here it's very natural. I can go to the double. I suppose it's worth separate place. Okay. I'll steal this one. So I have V. I have S1 going into PD1 of V. Then I have PD1, PD2 of V, which is quite easy to see that it doesn't matter how I apply those two. So it will equal PD2, PD1 of V. And then I have here PD1 of S2. So first of all, you have to realize that PD1 is actually a functor, so you can really apply it to morphisms, but that's really quite straightforward. And then you have this square, and you want this square to, so here you have, I suppose, D of S1. So it's kind of cluttered, but the idea is, I mean, once you do the computation, it's just, it's there that they really are commuting. Actually, if and only if the D1 and D2 are commuting, or maybe if and only if I'm exaggerating, but they do commute. No, now I really mean commuting, and actually I don't have the machinery to do it for the Lie differential field case. So I'm really restricting now to the partial differential fields from now on. I suppose it should be technically, I don't know. Actually, I don't want to say anything. But I am assuming from now on that I'm talking about partial differential fields. So D1 and D2 commute, and therefore this thing commutes. And the idea should be, so let us say it because time is running out, the idea should be to say that every such setup where I have some variety and some, let's say a couple, because n equals 2, so let's say I have a couple of torsor fields which are commuting, and for every subvariety of V, I have a solution to this, let's call this system star, I have a solution to star which avoids any given subvariety of V. So if you know the formulation for ordinary differential fields, that's how it's done there, basically, but here it's not good because I just dealt with the finite delta rank case. So I'll just really, really quickly say something about how we solve this. So actually I might have such a thing in which really I have more and more variables. So the natural way to think about that is like an inverse. So I want to translate this into a variety, but it's an infinite dimensional variety. So that's okay, but the best way is to somehow approximate this variety by, let's say, every time taking this much variables and calling this, for example, I don't know, Vm, if the length is, if all of the multi indices were their length, the sum of the indices is less than m, so call this Vm. Vm would be the variety of all the points which satisfy some number of polynomials, but and then I can just, you know, pull it back to n plus 1, just a projection. And why do I need that? Because let's say I wanted to I have here TD1 of the M. So this is where I want to send, so let's say I have here one of the variables, Xn. And I want to know what is the D1 of it. So the D1 of it is a new variable which I haven't met yet. It just exists here. So the S1, which is supposed to commute D1, is going to go diagonally. I cannot have, if I want to compute S1 of the variables here, I need variables which I haven't encountered yet. So the picture is something like, or exactly like this, where I have, well, so this would be need an extra index, unfortunately. But in general, I would want to think of this whole thing as some V, which is what you can call a pro-algebraic variety. So you have just a diagram of varieties with dominant maps. So you can think of it, you can think of the scheme hiding there, but no, you don't really need to. Just think of this diagram as some object, and then you have another such diagram, right? So you have all of this here. And you have to define what does it mean to give a map between one such diagram and the other. And to give a map just means that every such object has to get a map from one of these objects, but not necessarily, I mean, just from one of them. And there has to be some compatibility relation. So if this is the arrow going into here, and this is the arrow going into here, then there should be some... So it's quite natural. Again, I really don't have time to go into that, but it's really what you would think. So maybe I'll just use, it's not really fancy words, but it's easier somehow technically to define the pro-algebraic variety as a contravariant functor from some partially ordered set with into this. And then if you have, so this is actually a functor, right? I mean, I have this ordered set N, and I can, for each element of N, I find an element in the category of varieties such that if one index is smaller than the other, then I have the arrow the other way around. That's why it's contravariant. Then if I have a functor, and I want to apply this functor TD1 to V, then it's easy. It's just composition functors. But actually, it's also easy to see by the diagram. You take a diagram, you apply some functor, of course, you get another diagram. So this F will be given, so I might call it again S1, but remember that this is now a pro-algebraic variety. This is again a pro-algebraic variety, and the map is given actually by some compatible system of maps. And again, you can, so you can phrase what does it mean for S1 and S2 to commute. It's the same diagram, only in the pro-algebraic category. What I should be saying... what should I be saying? Well, I suppose that's it. So I just gave a formulation, but it's not a first order formulation at all. So I'll just say that you can, well, actually, I mean, this goes on forever. You cannot mention this in first order axioms. So you have to limit yourself somehow to finite parts of such diagrams and to have enough of those finite diagrams to regain the infinitary axioms. So this is just doable. But it's a technical thing. I will not go into that because I do have to mention something about 4. What is the... Yeah, what are the infinitary axioms? So the infinitary axioms would be just word for word. So claim, so this is not an axiomatization, but just a characterization, K, a PDF, K is differentially closed, so satisfies the null completion if and only if for every pro-algebraic variety V and S1 up to Sn, actually, because I might have N commuting torsor fields on V. And any W which is really contained in V, there exists, a U in V. So again, to give a point in V is to give a compatible system of points on every one of the varieties such that the same star, but we have to take the star with a grain of salt. So di of u equals si of u, but here we have to remember that if I want to compare, well, di, d1, my w is d1 star maybe, but d1 star is what takes u to u d1 of u, right? So I will have to make the indices work okay, but that's basically it. So the claim is this is a good characterization of being differentially closed. U is, there exists a U in Z of K, a K rational point, and not in W, of course. Sorry. And the first orderization, how do you call it? It's just, I won't go into that. I don't have extra time, right? We did begin on time. But at least my clock is cheating me because I made it, so I actually have 5 more minutes. Great. Good. So I have to go to 4 really quickly. So 4 is somehow a different context or an added structure. I want to add the valuation. So I'll just say, I suppose, in one sentence, the motivation given to this added structure, which I don't know anything about. I'm just saying words. So you have, you have a partial differential field. So it's a good way of talking about partial differential equations. And then if you add a valuation, then it's supposed to be connected to perturbating, or how do you say, a differential equation, a partial differential equation, because the evaluation you have things which you might think of as very small, infinitesimal, the things whose value is bigger than zero. And then it's supposed, Udi tells me that physicists really take equations and then somehow find things which they think of as small, and they have really good mathematical reasons to think of them as small because whatever, and then they solve some differential equation, but then they add again the small thing and think of the new differential equation as perturbating the differential equation where something went to zero, right? So this is, this is a good way to motivate things. But a better way to motivate things is that we have Scanlon's work on adding valuation to a differential field. Or actually, well, Scanlon does it for general D rings, which generalizes differential fields and difference fields. But let's talk about the differential fields. So the idea would be to generalize this and try to achieve a model completion for what I'll define now. So let's call it a definition, a VPDF, a valued P differential field is a P differential field with evaluation such that they have the same interaction as Scanlon assumes between the differential structure and the value, which can be stated like this, such that every ideal I in the ring, the evaluation ring, is a differential ideal. So that just means that di of I is in I, but actually when you look at it, it's just saying that you can just say it for principal ideals. And that's actually just saying that V of di of x is at least V of x. So that's a more normal way to put it, but it's equivalent to saying that every ideal is actually a differential ideal. So somehow, one of the main lemmas that he has to add for the model completion is the Hensel's lemma. So I suppose the idea is, you want somehow to do a back and forth argument, and you have, some solution on one side. So, well, you take its residue to the residue field, and in the residue field you really know what to do, and you pass to the other side, but then you have just an approximate solution. On the other side, you want to make it precise. So that's why it comes in. So I don't have, I'm not close to really having a model completion for this, and but somehow it might be interesting in itself to have a Hansel lemma, which might lead to a model completion. So actually, Udi has many ideas of how to achieve the model completion through other channels, but we don't have it yet. So. But at least let's state the Hansel's lemma, then I'll be through. So in Scanlon's work, he defines VHL, well, something like this. I may not remember all the conditions, but something like this. Well, first of all, you have to assume some conditions of the residue field. So if K, well, has enough constants, which means something, and is linearly differentially closed, which is more important, and given an approximate solution B to P of X equals 0. So I have some polynomial and I'm just giving an approximate solution, meaning that, well, the value of the result is greater than 0. And if, well, so let's write this as a polynomial in the variables x to the n of x, and if there exists one of the coordinates such that the partial derivative of P with respect to this, well, it's not exactly, forgive me, but it's not a variable, but assume that I wrote here xn, right? You can think of it as a variable, and if you compute it at this B, you would have, P is over R. That's important. So I'm taking a polynomial over the evaluation ring, and I'm taking an approximate solution, and suppose that one of the partial derivatives is 0. The value is 0. So it's just invertible in the ring. Then there exists a solution near B. So maybe, I suppose I should say something about saturation or maximality. I'm missing something, but that's a basic idea. So I just will give the generalization. I won't have time for anything, but never mind. So I want to think of this. So again, we are saying that this is an invertible in the residue ring, in the evaluation ring, which means that if it is sent to the residue field, it's a non-zero element. So actually, I'm looking at the gradient of P, and somehow, well, the gradient of P is just the, well, I should maybe write it explicitly, it's this up to this. And then I'm thinking of the residue of it, actually. And it's not the zero vector. One of the elements when I take the residue is non-zero. So I want to think of that. It's quite natural to think of that going back to the definition of the variety that we had. So the variety hiding here is defined only using this single polynomial. And actually what's being said here is that the gradient of this single polynomial at some point B is non-zero, meaning this point is a simple point of the variety. Right? That's just the Jacobian. The Jacobian here is we just have one polynomial. So the generalization would be if I have this variety for the, let's say first for the finite delta rank, and that's not getting to pro-algebraic things. If I get something of finite delta rank, and I get an approximate solution, and I think of it as this variety, and when I take the residue, I get a simple point, the idea is that then I can do the same thing Scanlan does, and improve this solution, and in the end find an exact solution. So I'll just write this at least, and finish. Right. So the partial differential version of Fermi's lemma would say, let's say, finite delta rank case. Says that if U in V is, so it's not in V, but I'll write it like this. So it's not a precise solution. It's just a solution up to some epsilon. So epsilon R is one is a ideal in R. So it's an approximate solution. An approximate solution. And the residue of U, well, since it's an approximate solution, it will be a point in what happens when I go down to the residue field. So I can take the variety and just, it's not exactly extending my scalars, right, because I'm somehow going down to K, so I might call this VK. It's the same variety defined when I take all the coefficients down to the residue field. So this is a regular point, or a simple point. And if, so this is the condition of regularity, that the residue, well, it really is here, because U was an approximate solution, but it's also regular. And if K satisfies the same conditions as in the original DHL, right? So it has enough constants, so it's, never mind. But actually, the main point is the linearly differentially closed, because, okay, so let's just finish the formulation. Then we can find, let's say here, just a better solution to be more sure that I'm not missing something. I just want to find a better solution near U. Better solution meaning that if the mistake here was this epsilon, so if the result was some at some valuation, I can make it better. And then if I have some maximality condition, I can get all kinds of pseudo-convention sequences and really find a solution. But just this is what I need. I'll just finish by saying that the way to do it is really, I mean, the way to approach it is quite straightforward. We're actually looking for the next Taylor coefficient in little k. Just wanting to improve a little. So we're looking to solve something in little k. So the idea is I have here some system of those torsor fields, etc. The idea is to move all this system down to k, to small k, to the residue field. But the main technical thing is the fact that if the SIs commute with each other, I want the torsor fields I get down on the k category also to commute with each other. So there is something to say about this going down to k. Once you do that, you really have, I mean, you're just using your assumption that it's a linear difference. So the main difficulty is of finding something that goes down to the k category of things over little k, and proving that it preserves this commutation. So since I was given that S1 and S2, for example, commute, I want to use that to show that after I go down to the residue field, still some torsor fields commute. But yeah, I promised to be vague, so I was at the end.